Electrician Conversations, a podcast for electricians hosted by an electrician. The Electrical Association is committed to keeping electricians in the know about the latest developments in the industry. Experts will be on to help answer the tough questions, talk shop, and give tips to make your jobs work.
Greetings. I would like to welcome you to another podcast presentation of Spark and Conversation by the Electrical Association. I'm Mike Miller, your host. I'd like to thank you for choosing this Electrical Association podcast for one of your sources for information for activity going on in the electrical trade. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to one of our sponsors, Federated Insurance, for being our sponsor for this and many activities of the Electrical Association. Today's presentation highlights an individual widely acknowledged throughout the electrical industry in Minnesota as the foremost authority having jurisdiction. That distinguished figure is none other than Mr. Dean Hunter, the Chief Electrical Inspector for the state of Minnesota. Dean works for Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry between offices in Alexandria and St. Paul, and is also active and is an education chairman for the Minnesota chapter of the International Association of Electrical Inspectors. He has served as an IEEI representative on codemaking panel number 7, formerly known as code making panel number 19, for the last 4 code cycles. He participates as an NFPA technical committee member on the correlating committee. Also, publications 225, 501, and 501A of the National Fire Protection Association, and is a member of the UL Standards Council. Dean, you sound busy.
Hey, thanks, Mike, for having me today. It's an honor to speak with your audience.
Okay. Well, great. I'm glad you were able to make it. Looking at all the accolades we talked about introducing you, it sounds like you probably don't have a lot of spare time. Is that true?
Oh, that is true. Unfortunately, there's obviously a lot happening here at DLI with the transition of inspectors, and we'll get into that here in a little bit. But Like I said, excited to be here.
Well, glad you could make it. So, Dean, could you maybe give our listeners some detail about your life and educational experiences and your current role with the Department of Labor as the Chief Electrical Inspector?
Well, you know what? There's nothing special about my experience or anything else. My guess is that my career is very similar to many of your other listeners. You know, I attended technical college at M State Wadena, and then out of school, I worked in the electrical field in and around the Twin Cities area. I was hired in 1991, actually, as an instructor at the technical college, which I had attended. And then while teaching, I started an electrical contracting business. After 13 years, I transitioned to full-time contracting. I ended up selling my electrical business and was a project manager for an electrical contractor that purchased my business. And in 2007, I was hired on as an area rep with the Department of Labor in the Northwest region of the state. And in 2014, it was Mr. Williamson and Sam Sampson at the time that had asked if I would come down and assist with the leadership team in St. Paul. And honestly, along the way, I've been fortunate to work with some great people that have mentored me along the way. So that's kind of it.
You know, it's nice to talk to the chief electrical inspector that's been down in the trenches with the rest of us. It's sometimes not that fortunate that a person of your stature, where you're at right now, has been in the trenches. And I think that's going to be a real attribute to making and continue to make you probably one of the best. So moving ahead, given the complexities of the National Electrical Code, the dynamic nature associated with enforcing it, what do you see as the biggest obstacle for electricians when it comes to compliance, or better put, why don't electricians comply with the code?
Well, you know what, Mike, that's a great question. You know, first off, I would like to believe that every contractor and or homeowner doing electrical work in our state wants a safe and code compliant electrical installation. But at the same time, I'm a realist. Plus, I know that my team of inspectors can't be everywhere all the time, right? So again, after being a contractor for a number of years, I am of the opinion that if a contractor or homeowner elected not to comply with the NEC, it would be because of cost. You know, the cost of electrical materials and labor has increased exponentially over the last decade. And as technology continues to evolve around safety, energy savings, lighting controls, energy management system, it all adds to project cost. And I honestly believe that an electrical contractor or owner that knowingly elects to stay away from code compliance is because they justify it by thinking the changes are not necessary for safety, or maybe that the customer complains of too much cost. And like I said, I hope that isn't happening. And you'd like to think that everybody's complying with the law. But I mean, like I said, I'm a realist. It, what I always tell everybody is, you know, unfortunately, we can't have electrical inspectors, you know, at each big box store every time a light fixture or a piece of conduit leaves the building, right? So that's just reality.
Is that the truth? Boy, I tell you, you know, I could almost stand outside of those places and rope up a few permits if you got real aggressive, but that's not the purpose. I could certainly agree with you there. Dean, the 2023 NEC has been in force for almost a year now. As the chief electrical inspector, are there any specific code changes that you can think of that may have resulted in a lot of violations because of misunderstandings of the intent of the article?
You know, I wouldn't say that the violations have been a result of a misunderstanding the intent of the new language. You know, what changes is always a learning curve for both the installers and inspectors. You know, that's why we have continuing education, obviously, with you guys, or the local inspector becomes, you know, a real important piece of that whole equation. But you know, one way that we at DLI here try to keep our inspection team on the same page is by posting a 2023 NEC FAQ on our website. And, you know, whenever there's gray areas in the NEC that we just, you know, we try to discuss those things internally. We network with other code officials, you know, around the metropolitan area, and also some, you know, code panel members that we all network with. And then we try to document that, you know, through the FAQ, and we put it out there for everybody to read. And the hope is, obviously, is that not only the state inspected areas, but also the municipalities would you know, take advantage of that document. And I'll just give you an example of one thing, you know, that we've tried to bring everybody on the same page. As you know, in Article 210.52(c)(2), it mentions about the installation of the receptacle on top of a countertop or a work surface.
And
right now, the new language, you know, it talks about the fact that those receptacles have to be in, on, or above if you elect to put them out there, right, on the island. And, you know, and the code goes on to talking about that if you don't put them out there, you need to have additional provisions for. And, you know, what exactly does provisions for mean, right? So, right. You know, as a part of our FAQ document, we kind of laid out for the contractors and installers to know that simply means it's a chapter three wiring method that has been extended out to the island. It also has a junction box with a cover. And that's what we put out there, and that's what the provisions mean, because a lot of people, you know, initially thought, well, if it's an unfinished basement or something like that, that you could forego that requirement of having that chapter three wiring method. But our position is that you always have to provide that chapter three wire method, because we all know as contractors, there's days that we return back to the job site, and obviously it's, you know, the lid has been sheetrocked in the basement or whatever, so that you can't gain access later.
Sure.
You know, one thing that I will tell you, Mike, that we've probably struggled with it. And again, I think anybody that inspects is probably going to give you a different answer to this question, you know, what they see the most out there. But, you know, probably the one that's been the most difficult that I feel to enforce is the emergency disconnect requirement that's required for all service changes. You know, if you remember back in the 2020 code, we had a little bit of a workaround because the language was generic enough to where we basically, again, in our FAQ said that if you didn't change ampacity of the service, disconnect, and a few other items, you didn't necessarily have to have that emergency disconnect. Mm-hmm. But, you know, now with the 2023 language, it clearly calls out replacements. And so any service change, obviously, in the state of Minnesota, it's going to require that that emergency disconnect installation. And that seems like that's been a pretty hard one for some people to grasp.
You know, when you say hard, I would probably want to guess that's more associated, as opposed to physical installation thereof, is more so the cost thereof that's dictating the descent, I guess we'd have to call it to be correct. But I think that's a good rule. You know, if I were an emergency responder, gosh, if I had to get into a place that's burning, I'm not going to go in there if there's energy on in there. And golly, you wait for a power supply to swing by and pull a meter, they might be on the other side of town reading meters or something. It's very difficult to say. So I think it's an excellent one. And I do have to say, I have to our membership and even the classes we provide for the public, there has been some dissent on that. But again, I think now that it's here, everybody knows how it works. That's a good thing. And one other comment I'd like to just make that you kind of jogged my memory, and that's the concept of the FAQ. I think, and I have used it, I think that is something you folks should promote the heck out of, just because it really does provide some very quick, very clean clarifications of what your intent of the code is. That is outstanding, I think. I'd like to commend the department for working that hard to put it together, because I know it takes time and bandwidth and everything else, but boy, I think that's a real tool for contractors. So moving on to the next question now, Dean, I'd just like to talk about the construction industry in general in Minnesota and the impact that the national trends associated with economic swings and unemployment inflation have done. Do you see that compliance with the code is affected by harder times perhaps because of inflation and employment, or is the compliance trend cyclic for other reasons?
You know, it's interesting, Mike, because, you know, everyone thought, and I'm going to say me included, that with the nationwide inflation challenges and the home interest rates, that the construction industry would have slowed a bit, you know, but that hasn't been the case. And you know, what I did, because I knew we were going to talk about this topic a little bit, is I wanted to put together some numbers for your audience to kind of understand what we're seeing for trends at the department, if you will. And so I took a snapshot of our electrical permits that have been filed over the last 4 years. And if you don't mind, I'd like to indulge you just for a second.
Please do.
In 2021, now remember, this is pre-COVID, but right around that COVID era there, we had 130,000 permits that were submitted to the department. And we performed about 177,000 electrical inspections. In 2022, that number went from 130. Now remember, this is when we started having issues with supply chain. You know, there was hard to get material. Of course, the cost started to increase. We saw that on the building side and all of that. And in 2022, during the, you know, the main part of COVID, we had the highest electrical permits that we've ever taken in. I mean, and we ended up at 138,000 permits were filed with the department. And we did 183,000 inspections in 2022. In 2023, now we're starting to see the trend downward, because as you kind of mentioned, you know, with the home interest rates going up, you know, supply chain is coming back now and such, but we still saw a better, you know, pretty decent numbers, I'll call it. We had 132,000 permits that came into the system last year, and we conducted as a department about 191,000 electrical inspections. And now in 2024, right now, and this was as of last week when I pulled the numbers, we're at about almost 22,000 permits in the system in the first 2 months. So it's, you know, we're bouncing that around maybe about that 125,000, I'm guessing. So overall, we're seeing a downward trend a little bit, but I just have to say that I'm pretty amazed, because I think all of us thought that with the way things were going with inflation and also the, you know, all the challenges with getting materials and so on and so forth and the cost, that things would go down faster than they have. And we've been pretty solid.
Sure. Dean, I got a question about those numbers. Are those electrical permits and inspections? Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Wow.
And just remember, that's in just the Department of Labor with, you know, roughly we have 70, you know, contract/state inspectors on the ground with, you know, 11 of my staff on the ground that's, you know, assisting. But yeah, for the most part, we're looking at, you know, 70 people providing a majority or the lion's share of those inspections.
Boy, they are not spending a lot of time at all the project, or as many, you know. I mean, gosh, that's in and out. But I guess, you know, to be efficient, you've got to do that. And, I even have an inspector's license from South Dakota. And I just kind of know that you can tell looking at it, the first minute you're in there, if you're going to have problems. And if they're good, they're good. But if they are problems, most of them probably pretty minor. That's good to hear. It really is. So, Dean, here's something else that's been kind of in, you know, I love to bug you about code issues, and we helped me resolve one. And some time ago, almost about a year ago, we got into one that you really provided some tremendous answers for. But I studied the code because I write about it and because I enjoy it. And a lot of our members do as well. And one of the things that I'm referring to right now is that our chapter one, article 110.17, which was a brand new article. And you know what it did to me in my mind is it provided some protection for contractors and for electrical people to say, look, if you're going to be doing stuff, we want you to be qualified. And, you know, in the conversation you and I had about that via emails, it really was clear what your thoughts on it were. So let's just, as we turn our thoughts to that, that section 17 addressed servicing and maintenance of equipment. For our listeners, I would like to read this to identify our subject matter so all can follow our discussion, develop the basis of my question. And here it is, 110.17. Servicing and electrical preventive maintenance shall be performed by a qualified person trained in servicing and maintenance of equipment and shall comply with the following. Number one, the service and electrical preventive maintenance shall be performed in accordance with the original manufacturer's instruction and information included in the listing information, applicable industry standards, or as approved by the authority having jurisdiction. And the second part of that, I know this is kind of long, but you can see why, because it's a big change, but there's a lot offered here. It goes in part two stating that the service and the electrical preventive maintenance shall be performed using identified replacement parts that are verified under applicable product standards. The replacement part shall comply with at least one of the following. Number A, be provided by an original equipment manufacturer. B, be designed by an engineer experienced in the design of replacement parts for the type of equipment being serviced or maintained. And C, the part that I'm asking about or curious about, be approved by the authority having jurisdiction. I find certain language in the new section concerning service and maintenance troubling, particularly where the code represents options obtaining approval from an authority having jurisdiction for instructions and information in part one, or approval by a reference part in part two. What are your thoughts on the authority having jurisdiction reference? And what other comments would you like to share with us about the, in general, about this new article?
Well, first off, Mike, I want to say, I mean, number one, this is a great question, but we always have to remember, and I don't mean to be this granular with it, but it's in the state of Minnesota, we do a very good job of electrical licensing and also permitting. And I know I've probably mentioned it to you before, you know, obviously we've had statewide licensing since 1937. We've had statewide inspections since 1951, and we do a very good job in our state. And by prefacing, you know, this whole conversation with that, we have to realize that this is the National Electrical Code, right? We know that there are jurisdictions and municipalities and states across our country that do not have the level of licensing and or inspections that are built into their programs. So, you know, when you look at the context of this, for me, it basically comes down to two things. Number one is licensing, and number two is inspections. So when I think of, like, in paren one, it basically limits service and maintenance activities to qualified people. And then number two, It requires that the replacement parts that you know, they have to be installed to the manufacturer's instructions, you know, including, you know, any sort of listing and such. But then it also allows, as you alluded to, the AHDA to give approval when the exact OEM part is not available. And you know, the thing about it is, I want you to know that, number one, I don't want any of my inspectors out there approving other than OEM parts. So we'll get to that towards the end of this. But I break it down, first off, you know, what are we doing about qualified people? So back to number one, you know, paren one, what do we do in our state to make sure that people are in compliance with being qualified people and or licensed? Okay. And we say that obviously it's our licensing laws. We know that when we talk about our licensing laws, that in our state, basically, as you know, other than a homeowner, we're not talking homeowner because we're talking about this, you know, maintenance and servicing. We're typically going to see in something other than a residential project for conversation. And when we talk about that, what can somebody do in our state? Basically, if I, you know, owned a donut shop and I was the owner and I had electrical work that was required to be done, what can I as the owner do within my facility that I own or lease? And the answer to that is basically nothing. You can change light bulbs and you can turn circuit breakers off and on, obviously, and replace a fuse. Otherwise, everything else, when it comes down to minor repair and or maintenance work in our state, is going to require some sort of protections in place, either through the employer, to our employer registration program, or it's going to be through an electrical contractor. So really, in the context of this, when I think about paren one, qualified people, we do it through licensing, okay? Right. And if anybody wants to get into that discussion about the two, you know, tiers that we have for our registered employer program, we can definitely talk about that. But you know, in the end, if you are a registered employer, it's going to come down to how are you meeting the law as far as your responsible licensed individual. You know, are they, if they're responsible for the installs for both construction and maintenance, it's no different than an electrical contractor having a master electrician who's going to oversee the work. The liabilities and protections are in place. If you happen to, you know, as a registered employer doing maintenance only, then you're probably going to have an outside electrical contractor that's going to oversee. Because remember, there's most of the installations when you're dealing with minor repair and or maintenance are not required to be inspected in our state. So if you don't have to file a permit on it, then who is responsible? And that is our responsible licensed individual, whether it be a contractor or an employer that's employed by that company. But if it's an electrical contractor, it's a no-brainer, right? We all know that it's going to be the master electrician that oversees that install. So you know, in the end, you know, going back to the whole replacement part issue, if replacement parts are installed and they're not up to the original equipment manufacturer's specifications or standard, it would be considered an alteration or extension of an electrical circuit, right? So that equipment would need to be third-party evaluated. And I know in comments that you and I had back and forth in our email, and I think that's you would agree with that, that if you take a piece of equipment and you alter that piece of equipment in the field, there's other laws that protect that piece of equipment and how that you have to bring that into compliance. So, and then the fact that you are altering that equipment then is going to bring in the fact that inspections are going to be, you know, required by our department or any other municipality. So in the end, I believe that our state, I am of the opinion that we are protected in our state for both, like I said, for the qualified people conditions that we're dealing with in the paren one and also in paren two. And like I said, when it comes down to the authority having jurisdiction approving anything, we're not in that boat. I mean, we will not go out and approve anything because I think that the guidelines that are set forth in our licensing laws dictate when, in fact, inspections are required and when they're not.
You know, Dean, one thing I think in your explanation just right there, as well as what you provided in the email, in Part C and Paren 2, where we're talking about be approved by authority having jurisdiction, if we were to modify that to fit Minnesota, to me, the right wording for Minnesota would be based on third-party acceptance.
Yes.
Isn't that about the best way to say that?
Yes, that is a great way to say that, Mike, because you're absolutely right. And remember, you know, we look at this being a pretty significant change, obviously, for the National Electrical Code. But remember, with the licensing laws that we have in place, we've been down this road for years, right? For decades. We've been in a pretty good position with this. And remember, you know, to think that every company out there is abiding by the law, and you know what I mean? I don't have enough foot soldiers on the ground to take care of every installation, obviously, but you know, we do our best, right? I mean, it's
sure.
And you know, as a department, we've laid the guidelines, and if people want to comply with the code or with the law rather, and the code for that matter, it's easy to do. You know, our registered employer program actually only cost $100 to become registered for 2 years, and that $100 is just basically for the compliance or the administrative piece of it. And then I mean, it's all legal. And your people minimally, you know, would have to be either registered with our department, or if they're licensed, they maybe have to take continuing education. But for the most part, it's fairly inexpensive. And it's good protections to have in place, because heaven forbid, if anything were to happen at that facility, you know, because of people doing, you know, unqualified people doing the electrical work, that would just be a horrible situation.
Well, it certainly makes sense that you get the registered individual in there. Boy, I can't imagine not complying with that, because nowadays, the way it's so easy to get sued without even trying hard. Well, I would sure. I'm thinking folks are on the absolute dead bullseye target on that and doing it right. So this is really neat to know that. I you kind of gave me the clarification in the email, but I wanted to hit it head on in the conversation, because your answers exactly parallel what I thought they would. And I'm glad you're doing it like that. It certainly protects those that are doing work. So shifting gears to other code matters, I'd like to do a follow-up question about some information you provided us about a year ago based on reconfiguration of forthcoming code books, specifically the 2029. You mentioned that the National Electrical Code book was moving toward becoming a 30-chapter book, focusing on the concept of grouping common topics to enable easy searches. Have there been any updates on this relating to timeline or other relevant information you'd like to share?
Yes, absolutely, I would. And here's a good thing, Mike. I guess if you're talking number of chapters, it's looking more so that it's, instead of 30 chapters, it'll probably be down to 20. So that's a good thing.
Okay.
But I'll just tell you, just for the 2026, the NFPA has just under 4,000 PIs, obviously, that we're dealing with for the 2026 NEC at the first draft stage. And as you know, we're working towards now, the ballots will be out here real soon, that we'll be, you know, solidifying the first draft. And so we'll all see that. And the reason why I bring up the 2026 part of this, because obviously as we transition, there's going to be some things that are going to happen in the 2026 that are going to align with the changes that are going to be made in the 2029. And you know, likely some of those changes are going to be like in the limited energy space, if you will. We're going to see more with parallel numbering. And with parallel numbering, obviously, Chapter 1 is still going to be pretty close to intact to the way that it is now, but Chapter 2 be very similar. But we're going to try to parallel number, if you will, Chapter 3, which will be the medium voltage, and then Chapter 4 will be limited energy. So going back to the limited energy discussion, is what's happening right now in Chapter 8 and in Chapter 7, they're trying to align those articles so they can easily migrate, if you will, to the new Chapter 4 that will be in the 2029. So there are a lot of things going on behind the scenes to try to make the structure changed easy, if you will, as we move to the 2029. And one of those things will be is there's a proposed annex that will be posted in the first draft that will come out for public comment, that you can actually see what the 2029 structure will look like. And and using that as a template, then we'll move forward towards the transition. But we've obviously met behind the scenes with all the panel chairs. There's been ongoing discussions, obviously, you know, with other organizations like NECA, the IBEW. There's been other great organizations that have put in some really good feedback, and we've made a lot of changes since we talked last. And same concept, just, you know, trying to bring it in line to where it's a lot cleaner, if you will. And I just think it's pretty exciting for our industry.
Hey, Dean, I tell you, I'm really excited to see it, but there's the guys like you and myself that we could shout out code references till we're blue in the face because we remember them all. We're literally in a start over position in some respects, aren't we?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are.
Whoops. We'll get used to it. We're never too old to change, I always tell myself. So I think that's true. I think it's going to be good. I know I've heard in visiting with a lot of people that I come in contact with providing classes that I tell them about this, something to look forward to. And they kind of look at me, are you kidding me? 20, 30 chapters? What are you going to do with that? There's not that much information. That's a beautiful part about it. There is information, but it's going to be presented in a fact that it's going to make it so much easier to, instead of like grounding, gosh, that's everywhere in a code book and almost every article or every chapter. It's all going to be in one point. Is that correct? Would that be a typical example?
Yeah, actually, like for grounding, for instance, in each of the chapters, like I said, the main body of the code book, if you will be driven by the first four chapters, as always, right? I mean, sure. And as the way it's going to be laid out is obviously chapter one will be our general, which will have our definitions, the 110. We're going to move the calculations into chapter one. We're going to move temporary services and probably energy management systems will be moved back to chapter one. In chapter two, it'll be pretty much intact to the way that we see it today. So it might, for us older guys that have been around for a while, you know, that's where we see a lot of the residential installations happen around chapter two, and a lot of that stuff will stay intact, so we can still, you know, impress the younger people coming up through the ranks with our code knowledge, right? But then in chapter three, like I said, we're going to be moving to medium voltage, and then chapter four will be limited energy. But the cool thing about that is each of those main chapters, if you will, less than 1,000 volts, over 1,000 volts, and limited energy, each of them will have their own grounding component that'll just be associated with that system. So it'll, and again, that's where we're trying to get the parallel numbering. So if you see article 250 in chapter two, it'll be article 350 in chapter three, obviously for medium voltage, and 450 in chapter four. So yeah, it's a nice, you know, clean layout.
Dean, one of the things that I got to ask you this while I don't forget it, but in writing the changes for the 2023 code over the 2020, it was a struggle to fill 16 hours. And you probably heard Marty talking about that, our friend, that he couldn't even get 12. He said, I got 12 hours. That's all I could get out of it, because it was such a meager offering compared to years where it's just beleaguered with code changes that were very significant. Do you anticipate that 26 will be similar, where it's not that many actual new items, but more so moved items and things like that?
You know, and I'm going to say, Mike, that it's going to be a mix. Just from what I've experienced on our panel, you know, panel seven, obviously, we've got article 547, 550, which is mobile and manufactured homes, 551 for RVs, and so on and so forth. And we have actually gone through some pretty significant changes, I will say. But it's more so to, you know, the technical changes aren't substantial, if you will. But but again, it's more just trying to line up with, you know, what we know the transition is going to be, and also to comply with the style manual. There's going to be a lot of changes for style manual. And the reason why is because we're trying to, again, align the book. And when you think of like the dot twos in all the sections is going to be for listing now. Dot three is going to be for reconditioned equipment. And what the whole code book is going to be arranged so that every dot two is the same, every dot three is the same. So just those changes alone, I think part of my correlating committee work, I submitted over 70 by myself, and I only did a part of the code book. So I can only imagine what my colleagues have done, with the changes. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff that's going on behind. But to your point, I think that, you know, with the transition, I think we're going to see a lot of those editorial changes to align for the new structure. And that will be the bulk of them, if you will.
Wow. That is going to be really a challenge for a code writer to come up with the hours, I think. And, you know, here's another thing when you start talking about that, and I hate to divert too much on that, but, you know, I know in the master and the journey worker tests, you folks focus on changes. Is that going to be difficult to focus on changes where they're more numeric than anything and positional?
Oh, absolutely. It's going to be a challenge because, you know, like I said, in the 2026, we're pretty much moving things to get them ready to move. So to your point, you could see some changes this time that'll only happen, for instance, say it's in 700, whatever, 725, 36 or whatever, and only to be moved to chapter four next time. So you'll see a new article or a new section rather show up in 725, but it'll be relocated to chapter four the next time. So again, it'll be a lot of number changing, but the technical content probably won't be that much different.
Well, that's amazing. I'm not going to panic or anything. I don't think anyone's going to panic, but we're certainly looking forward with anticipation of what could they do. But, you know, I think a lot of smarter people than you and I are working on this. Well, you're probably one of the on the top dog on the smarter end. But my point is, there's a lot of people that are doing a lot of good to make it easier on everybody in general. So, okay. Next one, we better move on. Gosh, I love visiting with you. Wish we could make this a 3-hour podcast, but we can't. But another one, on behalf of the Electrical Association, I'd really like to thank you for you and your co-sponsors on TIA 23-3, which resulted in a new exception to Article 210.8F. And of course, that was the one that had to do with the GFCI requirement for air conditioners, because you had done a study group or work group. I understand you mentioned that you found that the emission or the leakage current was far more than our Class A device was capable of dealing with. And because of that, if my mistake, correct me if I'm wrong, but that was kind of the reason that TIA 23-3 was generated. Is that correct?
You know, I just want you to know that I can't take all the credit for this, because honestly, I will say that initially, the first change that was made, you know, prior to the full-blown exception coming into the code, we were a part of it. Our Minnesota contractors were very instrumental in providing documentation, obviously, to the department, which then in turn, we went to NEMA and, you know, Schneider, their folks, also, you know, Siemens, all the big guys, Eaton, they were all involved in seeing that the compatibility was an issue for HVAC equipment in the field. And I want you to know, all the breaker manufacturers that I've dealt with over the last number of years related to this whole topic have just been providing excellent support and all of that to try to get this issue resolved. So, you know, Mike, again, I will say that it was our Minnesota contractors that really got this going, because to my knowledge, we were only one of the only states that put together a significant amount of data to back up what we were seeing in the field. And, you know, my whole position about this is, when you put our contractors in a situation where we don't have a solution to a problem, it isn't beneficial for our industry. It's not beneficial, obviously, for the electrical contractor. And you know, it's hard for our contractors to face homeowners and different people in the field that, in fact, are wanting their equipment to work, and all of a sudden it's nuisance tripping or whatever the case is. And so that, if I had a dime, Mike, for every time I've been asked questions about GFCI protection and HVAC equipment over the last, you know, 4 years, I'd be retired today. But at any rate, it's been a pretty big deal. But honestly, we're seeing a lot of good things happening, obviously, in this space. And I will tell you, and this is just what I know, because I glanced at the 2026 proposals. I know a couple of people on panel two, just to kind of ask where this was going, because obviously I want to know, because this has been such a hot topic over the years. And looking at the 2026 proposals, it appears that the panel is going to be voting on the date is September 1st, 2026 to remain. Now, initially, I honestly thought, when we started these discussions back, you know, a few years ago, that this date might get delayed, you know, even to 2029, because they were talking about that the standards, you know, around the HVAC equipment to, you know, to get the standards through, and then to get equipment built with, you know, the current inventory that was there, it just would have been problematic for manufacturers to be able to design and build, you know, to the lesser current leakage thresholds that we were asking them to do. And anyway, so I thought it would be delayed, but honestly, it sounds like September 1st, 2026 is going to remain. So with that being said, I noticed that there's another proposal, and this I cannot speak to a whole lot, because I was kind of looking at some of the proposals around this, and this appears like this is more of a committee input. But it's called a Class A high frequency GFCI.
Whoa.
And it appears that, you know, we have a lot of manufacturers, you know, device reps, panel board manufacturers, breaker manufacturers that are on panel two. And it appears like, it looks like there is some technology now that's being, you know, built around the high frequency leakage current, because there's debate in the field that, you know, the leakage current levels you know, due to high frequency is way different, obviously, than at the 60 hertz. And sure. And unfortunately, that's what all the equipment was designed to initially. So that it looks like there's going to be some movement on this. But again, we'll have to see how it all weighs out during the public input stage. But I would venture to say that during the comment stage, we'll definitely see some action here on this exception.
From the guy like me from the outside looking in, we're probably going to end up with another breaker, a different technology.
Yes, wow. That's what it appears. Yes, again, remember, this is still proposal stage.
Oh, sure.
Ballots have not been out there yet, but at the same rate, it does look like the breaker, I'm just guessing again, okay? But it looks like the breaker manufacturers have probably figured out a way to deal with the high frequency leakage current. That's my guess, just by looking at the proposals. And the interesting thing is, as you know, Mike, when you write a public proposal, and then as what happens is, or a public input rather, and the panel makes a statement on it, typically you can see why it was submitted. But in this particular case, this Class A high frequency just kind of shows up. And nobody comments on it. So that's what makes me think it was more of a committee input, if you will. And mm-hmm. It's probably a, you know, something that was kicked around at the code panel meetings that I did, you know, I didn't go to the panel two code panel meetings, but because that's happened on our panel as well. You know what I mean? When issues are being dealt with at the panel level, and you have, you know, you can glean some information from the UL guy in the room or the NEMA guy in the room or whatever, or manufacturer, you know, then you can incorporate those types of things to make the installation either more efficient or, you know, it's a solution to a problem.
Well, public input ever have any ability to squash this proposal?
Could a comment? And the answer to that is, I think that is what it'll come down to in the end is going to be this technology being compatible with the HVAC equipment. Because my guess is that, you know, and you know this because other code rules have been written like this, it's they'll throw the requirement in the code and the industry figures it out, right? We've done that in a couple different, you know, cases. Sure. In the code where, you know, when you throw something out there, I can speak to this a little bit. You know, we were talking about in Article 555, it talks about that you're supposed to have a leakage measurement device to test, you know, if you have slips that are more than three boats that mm-hmm. come in, or three vessels that come into
a slip. That comes in September, doesn't it, Dean?
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is there is, you know, we put it in the code. And now, you know, UL has now just recently come out with a standard, and there's manufacturers that are building to the standard for the equipment. So sure. It's just an example that you know, sometimes the code gets out ahead of it for safety reasons, and then the manufacturers come right behind and build the widget that we need to get over the mm-hmm. hump. So, yeah.
I hear you. Wow. My, stand by. We have a bright horizon ahead of us, it looks like. I this excites me to know that first off, the National Electrical Code is rising to standards that oftentimes they'd wait and see if it really flew and then they'd endorse it. But I hope that doesn't sound facetious, but my thought is I'm really impressed that they're really rising to the standard of new technology, especially when they invoked cybersecurity. I was, wow, that's right on top of it. Well, Dean, in the interest of time, I'm going to move on to our next question here. We understand the Department of Labor is switching to state-hired electrical inspectors versus contract inspectors in certain districts. Any information you wish to pass on to our listeners about that change?
I would love to. And honestly, we're going to see more and more of the transition happening as we move through, obviously, 2024 and maybe into quarter one of 2025. The transition should be complete for the whole entire state. So it's not just in certain districts. We initially rolled out with certain districts to jumpstart our virtual inspection program. But now that we're getting some legs underneath the virtual inspection program, we're now obviously transitioning more districts, if you will. And the most recent one that will be transitioning will be on April 10th. We're going to be doing the area. It's going to be the central Minnesota going to the east. And by July 1st, it'll be the Arrowhead region, and then the west central area of the state will be transitioned to state inspectors. As far down as, you know, the St. Cloud area, Wright County, Monticello, that area will be transitioned to state. And we'll continue, obviously, to roll out the build our virtual inspection team. And I just want to say, you know, John McNamara has been helping our team behind the scenes build our virtual programs, done a wonderful job. And we've had some really good support from our leadership to get the virtual inspection program off the ground. It's been a huge success. So looking forward to the future.
Has it been a problem finding inspectors that want to go full time with the state?
You know, it's interesting you say that, Mike, because, you know, just to give you a difference in what we've done last year versus this year, last year we posted what we called an RFP. It's a request for proposals to get contract employees to come to work for us. And we struggled with usually getting one or two applicants in some cases, you know, for an inspection area. I just recently, or our department just recently posted a virtual inspection inspector position, and we received over 40 applicants for one job.
Oh, wow.
That's so it's been real good. Yeah. Yeah. It's been great.
Fabulous.
And, yeah.
Boy, I'm impressed. Dean, if any of our listeners may be curious about other happenings at Department of Labor, what is their best path to additional information?
You know, they can always reach out to anyone on my team. And obviously, all of our contact information, if you go to our website at dli.mn.gov, and just in the search bar, just put inspector directory, and you can look up any city. Obviously, it could be a county, whatever, wherever the area might be, you can locate the local inspector that may be in the area, or, you know, the supervisor that's in the area. So, you know, I'd encourage people to go to our website to obviously stay up with the FAQ document. We are always making changes. When we have field issues that come up, my team gets together, and obviously we try to stay on top of that FAQ document for any changes that might be forthcoming. So again, our doors are always open, and I just hope and you know that the electrical industry realizes that we're all on the same team, you know, and for safety reasons, obviously we want to continue to do those inspections in the field, and we want to continue to build those relationships.
Well, I think you've built a very stable foundation to continue. It sounds like, Dean, your service to all electricians is especially important and appreciated. It has been truly kind of you to share your views and perspectives on the Electrical Board and the Department of Labor and what's going on there to promote the well-being of the electrical industry in Minnesota. And so another podcast draws to a close. I would like to thank our guest, Dean Hunter, for taking time out of his busy schedule to share such information about the code and other topics of interest in the electrical industry. Thank you, Dean. Are there any final messages you care to leave our listeners?
No, I just appreciate the opportunity, Mike, and it's always my pleasure to meet with you and your team and the audience out there today. And I hope that electrical contractors know that we're just always available for questions, and we'll help anybody work to a solution in the field. So, you know, I just hope too that everybody has a safe construction season ahead.
Well, Dean, thanks again so much for your time. I would also like to thank our executive producer, Katie Grahams, for her work behind the scenes to make the podcast happen. Also, a big thank you to Federated Insurance, who sponsored this presentation. With that, I wish you all safe travel until you can join us again for another Sparkin' Conversations from the Electrical Association. I'm Mike Miller, your host. Good day.
Sparkin' Conversations was a production of the Electrical Association. For more information, visit www.electricalassociation.com.